the Mother Earth call. I know that you can hear the Mother Earth call. I know that you can hear the Mother Earth call. Devastated soul through the door and down the hall. But on the way, you stumble, fall, and crawl.
Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of La Soul Radio, Panotique. This is Mateo, one of your hosts of La Souls Radio. Welcome, everybody, and thank you for clicking on La Souls Radio. Here's another episode where we are going to speak with the maestro, the doctor, Francisco, Dr. Pancho, as I know him, the brother. But the topic that we're going to be talking about today is integration of indigenous healing in the community and mental health practices. But just to give you a quick insight and a reminder, La Souls Radio, we always try to bring on guests, artists, professors, people who are experts in their field that could give the world view of indigenous people throughout the diaspora of Turtle Island. And here we are with Dr. Francisco. Just a quick background of Dr. Francisco. He's been a social work practitioner and educator in the community of mental health and wellness for, I think, over for 2 decades. Originally, I believe, in Los Angeles. He moved to Chicago in 2010. He was also the director of behavioral health in the Los Angeles area. But enough of me rambling on. I'm going to bring in the doctor, so he could share a little bit about himself. Come on in, brother. Welcome.
Orale, orale. Thank you so much, Mateo, for having me on board, man. I really appreciate this, and I'm honored. So just really quick about me. I was born in León, Guanajuato, the mountains of Guanajuato. My family are Guamaras, my abuelita, indigenous. We arrived in Los Angeles, and we actually lived in Inglewood in the mid-70s. Thereafter, I moved to the Valley, San Fernando Valley. But before moving to San Fernando Valley, we lived in Hollywood for a minute. So we were in Hollywood in the 80s, in the early 90s. And it was rough back in the day, man. Hollywood wasn't what Hollywood is now. And thereafter, we moved to the San Fernando Valley, where I went to school. Then moved to Highland Park. I forgot to mention that I went to CSUN, Cal State University Northridge, where I met many amazing professors there. Acuña, Ruiz, some really amazing professors. Jose Hernandez, cool people, man, that kind of mentored me a little bit. Mm. And then also got my master's degree at the University of Southern California. Master's in social work, and I've been a practitioner, community mental health practitioner for, almost 25 years.
Oh, right on, man. Yeah, no, it's definitely, a pleasure to have you on here. I know we've known each other for a week times 10,000.
I forgot to mention that you and I actually met at community college. You and I were taking a class with Professor Bautista. It was a Chicano Studies course.
Oh, that's right. Gilbert Bautista.
Yes.
Oh, damn. That's wild. That's dope. Yeah, he was such a great professor. He just lit that fire that was like an ember, when you're trying to figure things out. He kind of...
Yeah. He was definitely a great mentor to me. I remember... having one-on-ones with him several times, and I was going through some personal issues that he was able to kind of guide me through it. So, I really appreciated his mentorship and his guidance.
That's dope. Yeah, one thing that stood out about him and his classes was he would talk about, we learn all these issues, but you only get really 2 options when you get stuck. He goes, you either could be on this side of the fence or on this side of the fence, but you never want to be stuck like on the fence. That's just, and so you have to choose. Part of maturing is you have to choose.
Right. And the other thing that tripped me out about him was that he was a probation officer at that time.
That's right. I know.
He was a probation officer at the time in the San Fernando Valley, and also, then teaching at the community college. So it was an interesting kind of like perspective that he had, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. He went, that I was like, what? You're a probation officer? At that time, I remember I was processing like, oh, wait, which one of my friends are like on his case? But let me ask you, brother. From that point in Batista's class, how did that influence your worldview on the school to prison pipeline? Like, how did it influence you in that? Because I know that's like within your realm of work.
Yeah, no. You know, I got into the school to prison pipeline through, actually it happened in college. So there was I was taking this psychology course. And there was this white professor, and he one day he said, who wants to do extra credit? And of course, you know, I'm always up for doing extra credit. And he said, if you volunteer for this program called Friends Outside, then you get extra credit. And what Friends Outside was, it was actually a program in which folks signed up to go do volunteer work inside the juvenile detention centers. So I remember, you know, going inside the juvenile detention centers and just seeing nothing but black and brown kids. And that blew my mind. And also, what also blew my mind was these young people, these young men asking me, what are you doing here? Like, we've never seen someone like you here. It's usually white people or white women coming to visit us. And I said, yeah. Well, I had to be honest with them. I said, well, this is for extra credit. but I learned so much from them. And we were able to connect on a whole different level, right? Because, you know, I had known a lot of young friends, a lot of friends who had been incarcerated at a very young age. So that really intrigued me about like the juvenile justice system and learning more about the policies that push people out of schools, right? So that really got me motivated to not only go into the field of social work, but to also find ways to dismantle the school to prison pipeline.
Is that the project, School to Prison Pipeline Reversal Project?
Yes. So I was working at an organization in the San Fernando Valley, the Child and Family Guidance Center, and I was working under the multi-systemic therapy model. This model is really cool because it's more focused on helping the individual and the family understand how to navigate the different systems in the community. And the therapist using this model has a really low caseload. So their caseload is typically like 4 or 5 clients, and you're doing this full time. So a session would be, you know, working with the client and the family, but also a session could be working with the client, the young man, the family, and the probation officer or the teacher, or advocating for this young person within the juvenile justice system. So I would accompany my clients to the courts to advocate for my client. So there was this young lady who had just graduated from the School of Social Work at UCLA, and she was actually a double major. She had a JD, a law degree, and an MSW, and she basically found out what I was doing in the community, and she came and knocked on my door, and she said, hey, I got some funding to do this project. It's called the School to Prison Pipeline Reversal Project. And I said, well, what is it? What's your intention? What do you want to do? And she said, I want to approach the school to prison pipeline through a structural level. And she sat down with me, and she basically broke it down, and she said, we go into the juvenile justice court system, and we provide training to the probation officers, to the attorneys, to the judges. So we do all these trainings to inform these folks that are working with our young people about the issue of mental health. So I remember when she and I were preparing our presentation for the court judges, we had a PowerPoint of like 30 slides. And we only had like about an hour to do these slides. And we were putting all this information. And I said to Chantel, this is a lot of information. Do you think that they need this information? She said, yeah, you'd be surprised. These court judges are making decisions on our youth. They're incarcerating our youth, knowing that a lot of our young men have a severe mental health issue like PTSD or severe trauma, severe mental health issues. So we go in there and we're doing the presentation, and there was this one court judge who walked up and left. Because once we said school to prison pipeline, a person got up and left. So the other court judges were really asking some really good questions, some really obvious questions. And these are the folks that make decisions to incarcerate our young people, right? Mm-hmm. So at the end of the presentation, we said, we invite you to work with us. So they were curious about how that would look. So we said to them, any first-time offenders that come to your doors, refer them to our program. Don't incarcerate them. Refer them to our program. We'll do an in-depth psychosocial assessment, come back to the court, and provide you with the report of what we're coming up with. So the court judges went for it. They allowed us to do an in-depth psychosocial assessment with the young men and their families. What we found out after doing the assessments is that most of these young men that were caught up within the juvenile justice system had a severe mental health issue. I'm talking about PTSD, major depression, family disruptions due to domestic violence, substance use, et cetera, et cetera. And we also found out that a lot of the youth had a learning disability.
Mm.
Surprise, surprise, right? So these young men, young students are being pushed out of the schools because of these policies, you know, that these schools have. So once we came back to the court and said, hey, this is the report, the in-depth report, we would make a recommendation. We would say, send this young person for mental health services versus incarcerating them.
The recommendation for the youth or his sentencing, like what was going to happen to his sentencing.
Right. So we would show up at the sentencing and we would say, hey, here's the in-depth report. Now the judge has information, right, from the therapist saying, okay, this youth has a history of PTSD, major depression. Instead of incarcerating them, we would have an option of allowing this young person to come into mental health services, and we would be able to provide those mental health services and support the families versus incarceration. So 90% of the time where we showed up to the court with the young person, the judge worked in our favor and supported this young man and did not incarcerate them, but assisted them through mental health services.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's and what years was this? The reason why I'm asking, what was it? In 2010 or 2011, there was those judges who got convicted for pushing youth to get a guilty conviction, and they were getting kickbacks from these private jails. And that's like a whole other issue.
A whole other issue. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this was like in 2009.
Man.
2000, we kicked off the project in 2007, 2008. And, you know, this was actually foundation funding. What happens with foundation money is that the money runs out, right? So you have to kind of figure out ways in which to kind of continue this project. We also did a lot of work with the Department of Probation, the Juvenile Justice Department of Probation, and we did a lot of trainings for them. And, you know, I remember doing these trainings with Chantel, and some of these probation officers would get really upset because of the language that we were using.
What was it that they get upset? Was it because you're like humanizing the situation or why?
Not only humanizing the situation, but calling them out. Calling them out on how they're engaging with the youth that they're assigned to. I'll give you an example. So the job of the probation officer is to work with the family to ensure that the family is getting, you know, mental health services or other services to provide for the family. A lot of these probation officers wouldn't engage with the families, wouldn't engage with the youth that they were working with. So there would be a lot of tension. They would show up with a very authoritative kind of style versus, I'm here to help you, right? And, you know, there were some great probation officers that really engaged with us and really worked with us, but there were a lot of probation officers that were just very old school.
Yeah. Did you work, was it the probation officers that were getting the case or the ones that were within like the youth facilities?
Both.
Oh, okay. Okay. What was your experience with those two different ones? Because I know the ones that are working within the facility, like they're with them like every day.
Yeah, the tension's different, right? Because the probation officers that are working within the juvenile detention centers, they just have a lot of pressures, different pressures than probation officers that are working in the outside. In fact, a lot of the probation officers that are working within the juvenile detention centers are trying to leave to work in the community because of the stress and tension that happens within the detention centers.
Yeah. I know. I met a lot of good, just a lot of good men, even though like their situation that were as probation officers, it didn't allow them to even be just good men because of situations that they were put in. And I remember this one probation officer, he told me, man, I want to help them so hard. He goes, but even when we send them out, like there's just so much poverty and it's, you know, survival mode. He goes, so he was saying, the reason why I'm saying this, because, you know, when we would go in there and work with them, I would always include the probation officers. And so they would, this one DPO said, man, I'm just so heartbroken because I hate to release them knowing they have a higher chance of just returning or getting killed or caught up just because it's not, you know, we want them to be released, but we know that when they go out there, it's not easy. You know, some of them don't even have a home. Yeah. But you know what I mean? So I'm guessing like, yeah, it sucks. And I get it though, because a lot of them do act punitive though, right? Like they think that because they're like, they've caused a crime that they should be punished.
Yeah. You mentioned something that is really important and it has also been part of my work, right? The issue of recidivism. Mm. Recidivism is high. And you know, oftentimes...
Can you explain what recidivism is for those?
Yeah. So someone gets released from jail, right? And then a year later, they get caught up in another incident and they're sent back to prison. Or 3 years later, they come back to prison because they committed a crime, right? That's what recidivism is. So someone gets released. And then, like you said in your statement earlier, you know, the probation officers say, oh, we know they're going to come back. And it's true. They come back. There's high recidivism rates because we haven't figured out a system to help young people to be effective when they leave, right? Because within the juvenile system or within any prison system, it's not set up for people to be able to make progress once they leave because they experience nothing but trauma within the system. Right? So when they're locked up, they're not receiving the mental health services that they need. They're not learning about empathy because the young people, they know that they need to be aggressive because if they're not aggressive, then someone's going to attack them. So what happens to the brain is the brain is not, the amygdala is not exercising the skill that's really important to connect with other people, which is empathy, right? Mm-hmm. So when people are incarcerated, they're not able to exercise that part of the brain that they need in order to when they're outside working with other people, that there's empathy. So there's a lot of systems that are in place within our society that we need to improve in order to make sure that we reduce those rates of recidivism, right? I work with an organization here in Chicago where they have a program where when folks get released into the community, the program helps them with housing. There's a program where they can learn a trade. They receive mental health services, case management services, but there's very few programs like that, right? So when someone is released from prison, as you know, oftentimes they don't even have a home. And oftentimes because of because they were incarcerated, they lose that connection with their family members. You know, the family members, they don't want that person around. So they have very few resources.
Yeah, that's sad. Man, I get it. You know, I know you've seen it, and yeah, it's just unfortunate. I do want to follow up to what you're talking about in regards to, you know, the system, and in addition to the prison work. From an indigenous perspective, how does the concept of intergenerational trauma, with the idea of historical injustices, continue to impact like the present day well-being, challenge the Western tendency to view mental health issues?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I'll answer this question in a couple of different ways. So I want to talk about this concept of healing, right? So healing is not always about the absence of pain or symptoms. Mm. For a lot of folks, trauma lives in the body and the spirit for a lifetime. And, you know, a more realistic vision for me is integration, which is carrying pain with dignity and strength and not letting it define or dominate you. Healing can be like being present and connected with loved ones, regaining a sense of agency and purpose, self-compassion, even when there's setbacks, breaking cycles. A huge cycle that I've broken in my life is parenting differently than how I was parented.
Is that an example of breaking that intergenerational?
Yeah,
trauma?
Those are some examples of how we break that, right? So I'll give you another example for addiction. Healed may not mean never struggling, but instead building enough support, meaning, and belonging to live in balance or finding balance. Through a indigenous lens, healing is a lifelong relational and communal and not a fixed destination. Mm. So meaning that it's an ongoing for forever, right? Mm-hmm. And let me share a metaphor. I like to share this metaphor that helps capture what I just said. And this metaphor is the river of healing. And it goes like this. Healing is like a river. It's always moving, never finished, and it flows through generations. Sometimes it's blocked by dams. These dams are systems of racism and oppression, capitalism, colonialization, and poverty. But when we clear those blockages, the river finds its way again. Healing isn't about reaching the end of the river. It's about staying in the flow together. Mm. And ensuring that water is clean for the next generation.
That's beautifully said. So, in a sense, because so much of the work working with young people is from a quote-unquote Western lens, like how would you say the Western lens and the indigenous perspective differs?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one thing that is certain is that suffering doesn't come out of nowhere. It's entangled with capitalism, colonialism, racism, and patriarchy, just to name a few. So another example is addiction isn't just an individual weakness. It's connected to dislocation, poverty, cultural erasure, and lack of belonging. So, you know, that's a huge component that I think that we need to understand that we are being impacted by the external systems that I just mentioned.
Got it. So when you all went to when you presented those, 30 slides, at that point, did you see that as like the first steps of your, within your own work, of applying stuff that was culturally already embedded with you?
Well, you know, I have to mention that I did some work at the time. It was called the Latino Family Institute in East LA with Jerry Tello, Bobby Verdugo, Maestro Hernandez. And that's where I feel that I was reconnected to my indigenous roots, right? I was facilitating a rites of passage program, El Joven Noble program, for the institute. So I volunteered for many years there on Saturdays. And this is when I just finished college. I volunteered, and let me tell you how I met these folks. So I was working for an organization in the Valley, and my supervisor, Olga Duran, she's like, hey, I found this flyer. It's a fatherhood conference. And she gives it to me, and she's, and I'm like, I'm thinking, is this good or bad? Is she trying to tell me something?
She saw.
So I took a chance and I went. I went to this conference, and the conference was being hosted by, you know, Jerry Tello and the Latino the Institute, the Fatherhood Institute. And I went, and that's where I met Jerry Tello and some amazing Chicano men that were doing some great work in community. So after that conference, I was just like in tears about like I've never seen all these men, brown men, coming together talking about the importance of being a strong father, a positive role model. So I went up to one of the, so I think it was Bobby Verdugo. I went up to him and said, hey, how can I learn more? And he says, come and do volunteer work. So I signed up to do volunteer work, and that's where I met the Círculo from East LA, the Compadres Network, and I did volunteer work for about 2 years, and then one day, Maestro Hernandez was like, hey, I want to invite you to a ceremony, and I was like, okay, and he gave me like a list of things to bring, so I said, okay, why do I need these things? Uh-huh. And you know. And then he's just like, trust me. And so I went to this place where the ceremony was at, and it was actually in Lincoln Heights, top of the mountain. And it was really nice. It was, can't remember his name, Rudy, can't remember his last name, but it was his house where he had a temezcal right there in his backyard. So all these guys started pulling up, Jerry Tello and all of his crews, and we started doing ceremony. And, you know, I was like, when I was in the lodge, I was like, wow, I'm back. You know, like the memory came back, those memories came back. So that was a beautiful thing. And since then, I've been on this path of like integrating like indigenous philosophy within my framework of social work.
Oh, okay. That's, yeah, nice. Let me ask you another question that... not necessarily on, but have you received pushback from like other Native people or Latin or so-called Hispanic people, or have you received pushback from what you've been doing?
No, absolutely not. In fact, last summer, I taught a class in Mexico City, where I took 12 students, from the School of Social Work. And it was a migration studies course.
Oh, damn.
So
tell me about that. That's dope. The reason why if you could elaborate on it, because I mean, you know, the love-hate relationship with those who are from the South and migrated North. And I think you may have mentioned it, but correct me, that the concept of social work doesn't really exist in Latin America.
Correct. Yeah, that's correct. We have different frameworks, right? So yeah, for example, social workers in Latin America, Mexico, or South America, they're not allowed to practice mental health, like as therapists. Here in the U.S., it's different. Social workers at a graduate level were able to practice, you know, mental health, provide treatment, etc. But in Mexico and South America, it's different. They're more viewed as like social services.
Oh, okay. What would that be here? What would that be here? Like,
Here it would be like a bachelor's level, right? Someone that has a bachelor's level in sociology or social work, they're not able to kind of provide that mental health services.
Like getting housing, supportive services, like
right. And that's the difference. Yeah. So what I wanted to mention about Mexico, when I took my students, I was able to meet a sister from Xochimilco. And Xochimilco is an amazing place where you have the, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, the floating gardens. So they have the floating gardens there, and there's an indigenous Xochimilcas, the indigenous folks who are battling the government because they're trying to reclaim the land, but not only reclaim the land, but they're going back to like their ancestral ways of planting food, which is amazing. So
they're having their own decolonization as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So they invited us to come out to the floating gardens and to see what they were doing. And it was just an amazing place. And the sister, before we went out to Mexico City, she's like, "Hey, we want to invite you to a temezcal." And I was like, "Wow, that's powerful, right?" So like as a professor in academia, I told my students, I said, "Look, we're going to Xochimilco. We're going to learn about the history of Xochimilco. We're going to learn about these floating gardens and an indigenous style of agriculture." But the people also invited us to do a temezcal with them. And I'm not going to give you a negative grade if you don't participate, but I want to invite you to participate. And if you don't want to participate, you can just sit outside and just, you know, like, be there, and be with us.
And mope, No, I said that, not much.
And all the students said, "We want to do this.
Orale.
We want to do it." Right. And so this was a very beautiful thing for experience for me and also for the students. They participated in the temezcal that was led by this maestro from Xochimilco. And in the ceremony, as you know, when you go to a ceremony, you bring an offering. So I brought my tobacco, I brought some sage, and, you know, the maestro was like, "Muchas gracias, I really appreciate this." So he actually brought the medicine into the ceremony, and he used it, and he allowed me to sing a few songs, which I did.
Oh, nice.
And then the maestro said, he said, "You know, something very remarkable is happening, is that a lot of these nations are coming together and they're sharing their medicine. They're sharing their songs." And that's what we did in that ceremony. And not only did we do that, but also my students were able to engage in this and participate in this. And it was really powerful on multiple levels, but as a, you know, professor and in integrating my indigenous, philosophies, this was really powerful, right? Sharing the medicine, and the one thing that I always try to do is I don't push this my philosophy on anybody, you know. I share it and say, "Hey, you're welcome to participate." And
would that be an example of the difference between Western mental health and an indigenous perspective? Is you're not pushing it,
right? It's a great example. Absolutely.
Nice. All right. What about you? You were talking about it, but what role do you believe that land and connection play? You gave a good example with your students, but at least within the paradigm and through the U.S. experience, what role does land and connection to nature play in indigenous mental health and healing?
Yeah. I'm glad you're asking this question. So, for indigenous people, land is medicine. It holds memory, stories, identity. This connection from land, it itself is a wound. When you're disconnected from your land, it's a wound. Being with the land, gardening, engaging in ceremony, walking, listening, brings regulation to the body. It brings belonging. and balance. So Western mental health is clinical-based, office-based, and often very sterile and disconnected. So when I was in Xochimilco with my students, we were very connected on a whole completely different level. So integration of ideas are really important with an indigenous lens. Nature-based therapy, ecotherapy, community gardens, outdoor circles, recognizing that environment impacts the spirit and not just the body. Land connection is an alternative. It's an ancient and primary for indigenous healing.
And what we're saying, I mean, when you're saying land connection, are you saying go buy land as an owner, or are you saying develop relationship with land?
I'm talking about relationship with the land, brother.
Orale.
Relationship with the land.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to point out because, they, you know, in a Western view, in the Western society, it's taught that by you buying land, you're finding your own freedom. Like, you know.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, it's all twisted. It's all twisted, man. So, yeah, that's a really good question. I want to follow up a little bit more about what you said in regards to like the social framework. So, you know, many people like us only identify as Hispanics or American because of colonization and erased or suppressed indigenous identity. So pushback often comes from internalized colonization, a belief that indigeneity is distant or not legitimate. So I remember when I was growing up, I kind of felt that way, right? The disconnection. But then, as I mentioned earlier, when I first was introduced to ceremonia, I was like, I feel like I was reconnected to what was taken from me. Right. So for me, that was really important. And a lot of my students have also told me that, like when they come through my classes, after they hear me talk about how I engage mental health, they go back and start doing their own like research on their history. Mm-hmm. And then they come back and say, hey, check out, this is what I found out. And I was like, cool. So my goal is to trigger that curiosity within students, right?
Yeah, because it's a weird phenomenon when, at least when people generally migrate north in the past 70 years, like for some reason, people push you to lose everything, you know, assimilation, you know, with the people you leave home from, like the South, like it's just a weird thing happens where you're no longer a part of what was. It's just, I mean, what do you contribute to that in regards to mental health? If you would observe that, if someone shared that, like how would you handle that situation?
Can you reframe the question?
Like if someone, because I know like your students, you know, they're relearning and reconnecting. It's part of the healing process for the past 500 years. We understand that part. But if someone comes to you and they say, you know what, they're not, I can't go back to my family because they see me as a gringo.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's, you know.
And mental health, like how does that, from your perspective, indigenous worldview of mental health, if you were to apply your framework, like how would you advise social workers to handle that?
Yeah, it's you know, we use in social work, I don't know if I'm sure you've heard this term, cultural humility. Right. Cultural humility is different from cultural competence.
Oh.
So old school social work, you're asked to be culturally competent about a community that you're working with. That's changed over the years within the last 10 years, where what we're saying is like, no, we want you to be culturally we want you to use this framework of cultural humility, which means that you allow the client to teach you about their culture. Nah, you coming in with the, oh, I'm a doctor. I have all these degrees. I know everything that I need to know about your culture so I can help you. Right.
Yeah. I know.
Which happens a lot. You know, that happens a lot, right?
Yeah. You reminded me of someone, I was at a conference and someone, no disrespect to them, but it was kind of kind of, it was just weird. They got their, what was it? I think their PhD in Native and Chicano studies, but they started explaining to everybody about a ceremony, but yet they've never even experienced.
Right.
And it was just like, it was just bizarro. But I mean, it was like, it allowed a conversation to happen, which, I'm sorry, go ahead, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's actually a really good example, right? So just utilizing this framework of culture humility, you're learning from the person that is unpacking all these wounds, right? You're learning from the person about their culture. And I think that's really important within the therapeutic environment, right? That you're allowing the person to lead the therapy sessions. You're allowing the person to figure out what specific goals they want to work towards, not coming in and saying, hey, you have major depression, and therefore this is what we have to do to fix your major depression. So, you know, the Western way is pathologizing and only looking at a person through a diagnosis versus really looking at the person through their environments. And I think that's really
pathologizing important. Is like it's disease-based or it's within the body. Is that what it's saying?
Yeah. So pathologizing means basically I interview Mateo for an assessment and then I'm taking notes and I'm basically looking and searching to see what diagnosis I'm going to give you. Right. So I'm going to give you a diagnosis of major depression, generalized anxiety, and PTSD. And that becomes what the treatment becomes. I'm now seeing you as someone with major depression, uh-huh. with PTSD, without really looking at what's really happening in your environment.
So that's what
pathologizing means.
Got it. You know what the last therapist told me?
What's that?
After they asked me, they said, Mateo, I'll be back. I got to go see my therapist. And I said, oh, you probably got anxiety. You probably got...
You started pathologizing him, huh?
Yeah. But, brother, that is crazy because... So that happens a lot to our young people, right? Where they end up getting this diagnosis that not necessarily is what's going on with them.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was doing work in the community back in, like, when I was working with Chantel Bachani with the School to Prison Pipeline Reversal Project, and when I was doing my own work with young people and their families, and I work with this amazing child psychiatrist also at this clinic. And one thing that she would do is she would take the children off all the meds, all the psychotropic medication. Mm-hmm. And then she would do like a really in-depth assessment, right? And what often happens is that a lot of our young people get misdiagnosed. Mm. So there's a huge misdiagnosis of Black and Brown kids with ADHD. Guess what? They don't have ADHD, right? So the therapist meets with the child and the family for 30 minutes, and all of a sudden, pathology of ADHD. Well, guess what? Did you look at their environments? Did you look at what's happening in their community? Did you look at what's happening with the family's socioeconomic status, right? So because of that, then now kids are being placed on with medication that they don't necessarily need. So PTSD can sometimes, the symptomology could be very similar to ADHD.
Got it.
So there's folks misdiagnosing our young people, then putting them on medication. Guess what happens in 10 years from then? So it's a mess, right? Mm. So what I try to do as I'm working in academia and also training social workers is like, let's move away from pathologizing people to really looking at the person in their environment and looking at what are the systems that are causing all this tension within the individual.
Wow. So when you're looking at their environment, I mean, how do you remedy that? Because it goes back to even we're talking about the probation officer. When you put someone back in their neighborhood, a lot of people are hungry. Like they're already in survival mode. Like, you know what I mean? It's densely hunger. And we all know that throughout civilization, hundreds and thousands of years, anyone who does not have access to food has all these ripple effects. But how do you advise social workers that are applying this worldview to look at their environment when they're like, fuck, you got to move out? Remember back in the day, it was all about, you got to move out. Everyone.
Yeah. So, you know, mental health. So, you know, I used to use the word mental health practitioner when I first became a therapist, but I don't use it. I don't use it anymore. The word that I use is community mental health practitioner.
Oh, okay.
Which means is that, yeah, we're looking at some of the issues or challenges that you're having, but also I'm also helping you look at how the systems from the outside are contributing to how you're feeling. Because then what often happens is that there's a great deal of shame that happens if it's only individualized. Meaning, oh, okay, I have this diagnosis and I have this other diagnosis, and I'm feeling guilty about, like, oh, it's me. No. So what I'm saying is training social workers and mental health practitioners to look at the environment and how the environment is impacting the individual. At the same time, teaching social workers to also become advocates to impact change in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if what's happening in our environment doesn't change, guess what? Our people are going to continue to struggle with the challenges that they have because nothing has changed within their environment, within their community, or within policies, or within our society. So we're now kind of thinking about, like, okay, we have to train social workers to not only be mental health practitioners, but to also be community organizers, to be advocate, so that they can also be the leaders of change within our community.
Oh, so if they see any inequities, like if there's not access to markets, they should be able to even voice that as they're now part of the community, not just.
Yeah. So I'll go back to the school to prison pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned to you that we did trainings to the probation officers, to the court judges, right? And we also did trainings and presentations to the schools that were pushing the kids out. So we advocated at the school level so that they can change their policies at the school level. So that they won't be pushing kids out, right? So as a social worker, as a community mental health practitioner, that's what we do. We challenge these systems that are oppressing our community members, right? So not just sitting in an office and doing talk therapy, but also going beyond doing talk therapy and also looking at the systems that are oppressing people in our community and also challenging those systems by doing advocacy work, by doing community organizing work, by doing work that's important to reduce those stressors in our communities.
I like that because it's kind of like you're like, you know, the concept like with men's work, like we walk with our brothers. So that's what you're saying, right? That's a very indigenous concept that I know exists within North America is we walk
We're doing the model that we use is accompaniment.
Oh, okay.
We're accompanying our clients to the schools. So are you familiar with IEPs?
Yeah, yeah. Is that like with the special ed or the
individualized education plans?
Yes, yes.
Right? So there's
alumni. I'm alumni.
So there's a lot of language that parents don't understand, right? With the IEPs. So I've actually gone to IEP meetings with my client and their parents to advocate and sit in those meetings because those meetings could be very intimidating.
Yeah. Right?
So I accompany my clients and their parents to sit in those meetings to make sure that my client is receiving the services that they're by law are supposed to be receiving. Another example is that I'm mentoring this program. It's called Centro Sanad here in Chicago, and they accompany their clients to court meetings, like when it's like DV cases or other issues that are happening. That's part of like supporting the client, right? We're going to accompany you to these visits and advocate with you.
I see. So I have a question about treatment plans. Have you ever, can you ask if you know if any therapists or people who provide treatment plans, if they ever incorporated to have the patient do gardening? Or is that allowed to be included in a treatment plan?
It didn't used to be allowed.
There you go. Let me put my name on that. Mateo said. I was just curious because I know what you were sharing of, like, you know, the students got to experience it. Like you walked with them and did this form of healing. And then you mentioned about, you know, working the connection to the land. So I was curious because even to my friends who are out here in LA who are therapists, I'm curious, have they ever added in the treatment plan? Show them how to get access, or they could go plant something in their balcony or in a pot. Like, is that part of a treatment plan?
I would say yes, but maybe not that defined, right? Mm-hmm. Some therapists will define it that way. Like, for example, like I used to engage in family therapy a while, you know, some time ago. And in my family therapy treatment plans, I would say, the family is going to play from this time to this time on a weekly basis. And then the family would come back and I would say, so how did we do with the goal that you all identified?
Uh-huh.
And you know, it depends on which family I was working with at the time, but family members were engaging. And that was a treatment goal that the family identified because there was a lot of disconnection within the family system, right? So I think that therapists now are becoming more creative in understanding how to incorporate those types of goals in the treatment plans.
Got it. Okay, no, that's good to know. I mean, yeah, I'm sure, I know you do the work. That's why we're saying it, so people are listening. Hint. But let me ask you, brother, reflecting on your life's work and in your own personal journey, what has been the most significant evolving belief or corrected misunderstanding about trauma and healing or just human nature?
Yeah. That's a really good question. So I used to see trauma as something individual, like it belonged only to the person living in it. But I've learned that trauma is also collective. It moves through families, communities, and even nations. Understanding that has shifted my work. I don't just ask what happened to you, but I also ask what happened to us. And for a long time, I equated resilience with enduring pain, but I now see resilience as the ability to create joy, to imagine a future, even when systems try to erase us. That's a deeper form of healing. My biggest shift has been realizing healing isn't about erasing wounds. You can never erase wounds. I always talk about that wounds are kind of like scars.
Uh-huh.
It's about carrying them differently, with dignity and connection. The question I keep asking myself is, how do we heal in a world that is still causing harm? And what legacy are we leaving for the next generation?
No, that's powerful, man. That's powerful. Yeah, I mean, it could be... at times, it could be disheartening, though, right? Especially in these current times. It could be disheartening,
like, brother. This morning I had a run in with ICE.
In your coffee?
Yo, I was coming down to my office and I had a run in with ICE.
Fuck.
And I came into the office a little like you know, disjointed.
It's
a little
crazy.
Bit.
Crazy, yeah, it is crazy.
So that's the kind of things that we're dealing with right now, right? So, yeah, it's. You know, my thing is not to lose hope, to continue doing the work, and you know, we're doing some some good work in here in the community here in Chicago and little in the Little Village community.
Yeah, based, I mean, the eyes, the Gestapo, based on what's going on, and we've kind of, this is like amplified. I know we've experienced, you know, the migra. I mean, it's even a running joke in our community for many generations.
Yeah.
But now it's just like, it's really on steroids. What are some of the, what's the advice that you could give mental health practitioners for people who are, you know, not, maybe they're not working with, because people aren't going into therapists to say they need help because of ICE. They're trying to figure out how they don't get deported. But what do you advise people who are within those communities that are working in mental health that are within their proximity? What do you advise of those folks, primarily the social workers or therapists?
Yeah, so it's time to come out of isolation, to work collaboratively with other systems or other organizations that are doing the work. I think it's really important, you know, being only just a mental health practitioner. And I've seen this. Some folks who go into this field who just want to be mental health practitioners, that's all they want to do. They just want to do talk therapy, right? And I think that hurts their clients, because if you don't know what's happening outside in our communities, then how can you support your client if you're just focusing on pathology, right? Mm. So my recommendations for social workers or for mental health practitioners is to connect with other organizations that are doing work in the community, similar to yours, in regards to either advocacy or community organizing. I think that's really important. So right now here in Chicago, we have a really strong network of social workers and community organizers. And even, you know, the city of Chicago has been responding really well in coming together and organizing. Like, we have one of the biggest Know Your Rights campaign right now that's really active, and that's moving really good. So just connecting with folks that are doing the work in the community.
Right on. Cool. And can you share another solution in regards to a framework of the difference between a Western framework and indigenous worldview of social work? If you could share, what are some solutions that we can continue moving forward that'll help other people that are coming in this path?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, Mateo. And I want to share some of the work that I'm doing right now. So as you know, as you mentioned earlier, I'm an academic. I teach full time at a university. I taught at Loyola for 3 years, Loyola Chicago, and I just started working at Erickson. I'm a year in, and part of the work that I do is as an academic, I'm also a researcher. I come into communities and integrate some projects, research projects. I don't like to call them research projects because I really work with community on these projects. Mm-hmm. You know, I consider myself a practitioner that's coming into research. Oftentimes it's the other way around. Research, mm-hmm. you know, come into community. But I really, my identity is really of a practitioner. So the project that I have in community right now here in Little Village is a really cool project called it's called Roots. And Roots stands for Restoring Opportunities and Overcoming Trauma Systematically. And this is an initiative that we started in January, and I'm following the Three Sisters model. Mm. The Three Sisters is an indigenous agricultural system. It involves interplanting corn, beans, and squash mm-hmm. in a symbiotic relationship that enhances the soil health, conserves resources, and maximizes yield. So how does it work? So the corn provides a natural trellis for the beans to climb, supporting their growth. Beans add nitrogen to the soil, improving the soil's fertility for all three crops. The squash spreads along the ground, shading the soil to retain moisture. It suppresses the weeds and deters pests with its prickly vines. So this framework has a cultural and ecological significance. This system aligns with indigenous ecological knowledge, promoting sustainability and biodiversity. The Three Sisters represent cooperation, balance, and interdependence. reflecting indigenous values and reciprocity with nature. The combination provides a balanced diet nutritionally. Corn provides carbohydrates, beans supply protein, and the squash provides vitamins and minerals. So I love tortillas and I love beans. So it's like, yo, like we're bringing this indigenous frameworks back into community. So how do we use it within this Roots Initiative? So the community is the corn, the foundation of the ecosystem representing cultural knowledge, lived experiences, and local support networks. Just as the corn provides a structure for the beans to climb, a strong community creates conditions for nonprofit organizations to thrive. So guess what? The nonprofit organizations are the beans. Like the beans that enrich the soil with nitrogen, nonprofit contribute essential resources, services, and expertise that strengthen the community and its schools. Their success is deeply intertwined with the community support. And the squash is the community schools. The final layer of the system is the schools spreading their influence like squash vines. They protect and nurture children while benefiting from community and support from community nonprofit organizations. Schools provide a structured space for learning and healing while also receiving reinforcement from the other two sisters. Together, these three systems create a resilient, interdependent ecosystem that is not reliant on external forces, but it's self-sustaining from within. So what we do within this framework is we facilitate systemic change by providing workshops and training sessions on early childhood education and mental health across community spaces, nonprofit organizations, and community schools here in Little Village and the Chicago Southwest Side and South Side that are led by three clinicians. I'm one of those three clinicians, and these workshops are available in Spanish and English. Some of the topics that we have introduced are understanding childhood trauma, teaching with compassion, the impact of machismo and toxic masculinity on early childhood, ooh, healing the healers.
We gotta do another one on that one.
Yeah, for sure.
That's
for sure.
Crazy. Yeah, go for it, Ross. I didn't mean to cut you off, but
it's all right. It's all right. Healing the healers, as you know that one too. Self-care for service providers and teachers, social emotional development and challenging behaviors, healthy parenting. And the other thing that we do is we're co-creating workshops and trainings tailored to the schools or community or nonprofit organization specific needs. And the goal is to reinforce the project's commitment to a community-led solution. So a lot of the other trainings that we've done in community have been co-created with the schools, with the community leaders, and really based on their very specific needs. So as I mentioned earlier, this initiative took off in January. It's doing really well. And it's really like reinforcing what I said earlier about organizations connecting with each other to support each other, right? And I'm really excited about this project. And it's a grant-funded project. It ends in June 2026. My goal is to look for further funding so we can continue this project.
Right on, right on. And how can people get a hold of you?
LinkedIn. You can find me on LinkedIn. My address, my email address is flosornio@erickson.edu. I'll repeat that again, flosornio@erickson.edu.
Orale. And no TikTok? We got to put you on TikTok, man.
Sorry, man. I pass on TikTok. I'm not that tech savvy yet.
You got MySpace?
I'm still using AOL.
Oh, damn.
But I heard that they discontinued it. So
They did. Yeah, they cut it out. Yeah, I'm curious if anybody still has that email address. But that's funny, though. That's funny. Thank you, brother. Thank you. And those folks who want to connect with the doctor, and I refer to him as Pancho just because I've known the brother. And if you want to connect with the doctor, we're going to put it in the details, his email or his contact information, so you can link up with him. Because it's important that we build community together and we learn from each other. At this point, I like to there's a portion. We just honor people who have became an ancestor. And it's real brief. So you could go ahead and, you know, we kind of go back and forth and just share about, you know, people who became an ancestor. And so for myself, as you all know, who I like to honor both my parents who became ancestors in the past 16 months. Mm. I want to honor them. And also Enrique from Tia Chucha's who transitioned. Go ahead, brother. Anyone you want to honor?
Yeah, man. I have a couple folks. My abuelita Esperanza, who transitioned some time ago. My father-in-law who transitioned, Pedro Morales, great, great, great role model who transitioned a few years ago. And, you know, our folks that are struggling right now in, you know, these war-torn countries. Mm-hmm. I want to honor them too.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for honoring those folks and all of our relatives who have transitioned, especially those who have been kidnapped by the Gestapo. Want to honor those folks. And also to those people, I just want to share, those people who have citizens who live in brown communities, please step up and be an advocate and use your voice and your privilege to help our community and our relatives. We want to thank you dearly, Pancho, for joining us on Lost Souls Radio. And I close out with this. You can't lead the people if you don't love the people. You can't save the people if you don't serve the people. And that's Dr. Cornel West.
I'm a lost soul. I'm a lost soul. We're the lost souls. We're the lost souls. We don't know where to turn. We roam out of control because we're the lost souls. We're the lost souls. We're the lost souls. We're the lost souls.
Daku Oyasi, to all my people.